I think it's about time to start. I am Peter Mercer Tabor. I have seen many of you before, met many of you. There are some new faces. As we did not meet yesterday, that is, this is a Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday schedule we have for this class. I'm going to assume that there are a few people who are new to this entire series that we're embarking on the third issue of this evening, Making Christian Sense of Contemporary Popular Song. I'll spend about 45 seconds saying a little something about myself and about this series, and then we will dive into the material for the evening. I'm a music historian at the University of Minnesota. I really do more reputable work by day. I'm a Mendelssohn scholar, chiefly. Felix Mendelssohn is my what I'm sort of best known as a student of. In the course of my work as a music historian, but I have also written and taught a certain amount about American popular song and a certain amount about hymnody as well. I've gotten around a little bit, and this happens to be a moment in the musicology field in general, in its history, its sort of explorations and its unfoldings. It's a moment at which popular music is becoming more and more reputable and more readily acknowledged sort of valid subject matter. And I've done a certain amount of that sort of thing. For one thing, it's becoming clear to me at some point in the near future I'll be passing around handouts. I think I have 24 of these, and so we'll be doing a kind of two-to-one situation. It's a pretty full house this evening. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. As I said at our first meeting on Monday, this is going to be a pretty loose-jointed series of conversations, some of which have more, some slightly less to do with the central topic, what Christian sense is to be made of mainstream popular music. To say something I've said at the outset of each session so far, my purpose here is not to sort of dive into the vast ocean of popular song as we hear it on the radio and pull out legitimately Christian songs and say, look, here's an artist who obviously is holding up Jesus Christ as his personal savior and trying to sort of get that message across. My purpose is rather to hold up songs that are not doing that, songs that are just sort of out there in the great kind of secular morass of modern popular music, and to ask of them, what can Christians do with them? That is, are there ways in which we can negotiate with these songs, in which we can craft our own kind of interpretive frameworks within which to explore, to accept, to learn from, to be nourished by music that may not really have been intended for the purpose of Christian consumption at all. At our first session, we talked about issues of redemption in a series of arena rock songs from the mid-70s. In the second section on Tuesday, we talked about some songs that seem to be making light of the image of God, songs that are sort of novelty tunes that have God held up as a kind of comic subject. Today we are turning to something much more forbidding than that, a task that Christianity has taken on as one of its central preoccupations. What do we do about the problem of evil? In the case of the three songs we're hearing tonight, it is evil of a very particular kind, unjust death. Those of you who've had a chance to listen to some or all of the Dostoevsky sessions that are going on these days too, that my friend Doug is teaching on the Brothers Karamazov, you will understand that for Dostoevsky, the problem of the unjustified death of children is a kind of central preoccupation of this book that crops up, has various manifestations throughout Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov. Less so with popular song. There isn't all that much pop music out there that wants to confront the problem of evil, the problem of unjustified death, but there is some. And tonight we're just kind of sampling across the last 20 years or so of pop music, listening to two, perhaps three specimens of songs that take the problem on. The first of these is a song that appeared on Bruce Springsteen's 2002 album, The Rising. We talked about a 1975 Bruce Springsteen song in our section on Monday. We listened to his Born to Run. We are here reaching a point closer to the modern manifestation of Bruce Springsteen's artistry in this 2002 album. This album, The Rising, was an album about the events of September 11th, 2001. This was Bruce Springsteen's artistic response to the events of this date we all just call September 11th. And the song that we're going to begin with is one called Empty Sky, which I suppose you could say was released as a single. I'm not sure it was ever really a big hit, but it's a song from the album that got a great deal of attention, that got many people kind of sitting up and saying, well, look, we're dealing with one of the sort of grand masters of American popular song here, making his own seemingly understated, but clearly very heartfelt response to this terrible event in our collective our collective experience. And tonight we're going to face this song, Bruce Springsteen's Empty Sky, about the events of September 11th, 2001, and ask, what do we do with it? What does this song have to teach us? What kind of attitude does it strike? What kind of emotions does it seek to engender? That is it actually trying to stir something up? Or is it trying to communicate something, trying simply to share something that we all experience in a communal way? So once more, I'm going to hand around a lyric sheet here. Perhaps if three of you can share each of these things, that would be nice. We'll see how far they go. In this particular case, and in a sense all of our songs this evening, none of the lyrics are all that hard to understand. If you don't have access to a sheet of lyrics at all, it's not going to be the end of the world, but get close to one if you are able. Unhappily, we transcribe, we comb through, we do our best, but still we make mistakes. I made a mistake in the fourth line of this transcription. It reads, in the bed there you used to be. This is not the line. The line is the bed where you used to be. Just an empty impression in the bed where you used to be. Let's listen to the first verse and chorus of this song. How far did the lyric sheets get? Are we not very far? Okay. How far this time? I'm going to call on my wife to do me a favor. Beth, would you mind running upstairs to the orange door and seeing if somebody in Media Ministries might be able to come run some of these off? Okay. Do we have somebody from Media Ministries in the room with Michael? No. Would you be able to? Carol or Michael might be up there. Thanks. We're going to begin by listening to a single verse and chorus. This is a song that unfolds sort of a three-verse, sort of verse-chorus things. Let's listen to one verse, one chorus. And I want to ask you sort of three basic things about this song. In the first instance, in the course of what we're about to hear, 45 seconds, what is the most striking thing that happens as far as the lyrics are concerned? Is there something that happens in the words that just sort of jumps out and bites you on the leg that for whatever reason really seems to drive something home? Secondly, is there something that achieves that in the music? Is there a moment at which the music does something sort of transcendent, something epiphanic, something visionary? There may not be. You may find this just a kind of tedious song. Not a lot happens in this song musically. Not all that much happens lyrically. But if something of particular importance happens, register that. What happens in the lyrics? What happens in the music? And then what I hope will be a slow lob, why is the sky empty? The song is called Empty Sky. Let's see if we can get that cleared up by the end of this verse-chorus pair. Why is the sky empty? I So what about it? Let's start with the easy part. Why is the sky empty? What does that mean?
Towers of planes.
Okay. There are towers that are gone. I mean, this is a big one. There are twin towers that have been knocked down.
No planes.
And it's true. Those we'll all remember. Old flying was shut down for a time. I don't remember how long.
2 weeks.
But 2 weeks. So you wake up, no planes in the sky. There you are. Other things?
The open snare sounds like a funeral drum.
Excellent. Well, this is a question. I hadn't quite figured out how to craft this question, but that's the question. What's up with that open snare? I'm glad you bring it up. How do you mean? What about it?
It just sounds like a dirge drum from a New Orleans wake or something. You know, with the open snare, there's that vacancy to it. Just
yeah, excellent. This thing continues to beat as it's always beaten, but now empty somehow. That's an interesting thought. Let's sort of get off the bus there for a second. We're not done with the empty sky just yet, but let's talk about the empty drum. Let's talk about the whole musical fabric of this song. What is, if you couldn't understand the words of this song, this is one of my favorite questions, if you couldn't understand a single word, what would the music itself be communicating? What would you, is this a happy song? Is this a dancing song? Is it a sad song? What is the music of this song about?
Loneliness.
How so? What communicates that?
A boy, she's not in the bed. And then all of a sudden he says, I survived. So it kind of says one thing and all of a sudden it turns to the immediate of
okay. Well, let's go there. And we can come back to the music question. I mean, we have this lyric thing before us. And I think maybe many of us might have had the same response to the question. You know, is there a really vivid thing that occurs in these lyrics? I think for many of us, it may be this eye for an eye thing. And why is that so powerful? Somebody else speak to that. What happens at that moment? I mean, what can we say about that?
Revenge, maybe?
Justice. And justice. And justice might look like this. Yeah.
Well, I found that line surprising because to my ear, the music just was kind of plodding along, same old thing, and all of a sudden, an eye for an eye. So, violent thing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of energy in that lyric that wasn't, to my ear, reflected in the music.
Excellent.
But I think a lot of us are conditioned to, when we hear eye for an eye, to hear Jesus criticism. So I think he's playing on that conditioning too.
Right. Playing how? I mean, to
well,
what
not
effect?
Playing, I don't mean that in a manipulative way. But but that is part of the response he's trying to evoke. First to validate that we've been hurt and have a desire for revenge, but then perhaps also to use language that reminds us that we may not want to take
right.
it.
Yeah.
But it's a pun.
How so?
Well, eye for an eye is like his eye to his.
You see, now that's what I read into it. And when you guys said the other, I was like, oh, yeah.
Which is to say, when we say, I want a kiss from your lips, I want an eye for an eye, which is to say, here's my eye looking, where's the eye that I want to be looking?
It was obvious that he was going double one time.
Very interesting.
Yeah, for me, the first response is because the phrase is so familiar, an eye for an eye, and so on. I mean, that's the first place I went. What I love about it is it feels so psychologically true that there's this intense longing. I want to kiss from you, but at the same time, there's rage. Yeah. Both of those things are existing simultaneously.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is the effect? I'm going to go back to you, blue shirt, back row. What is the effect of the kind of dissonance between the rage, as we put it, the rage of these words, and the music that doesn't contain that rage? I mean, if this were the moment at which the three electric guitars came crashing in and stuff, and you say, oh yeah, he's really mad, but that doesn't happen, what does happen? I mean, what's your feeling about this? Why is the music so understated? What does that do?
To me, it kind of, I don't know, one thing that comes to mind for me is so that sky is empty and there's kind of this void in him as well. It's kind of,
Yeah.
I sort of liken back, I was numb. Mm-hmm. And I sort of get that feeling from the music, which is sort of.
Excellent.
I think not only the sky is empty, but his dreams are.
I find his accent,
he's kind of in the same mode as he was in the Nebraska album, that very really rough accent and kind of hard to understand because he's not always that way.
Right.
And it's very rough, hard the lyrics anyway, and he's kind of back in that mode.
Yeah, and those of us who've been here from the beginning of the week, we have talked a little about an album we haven't heard any of, but the Nebraska album, an acoustic, I mean, a deeply intimate, acoustic album that Springsteen put out that's far from what many of us think of as this sort of classic sound, yes.
Actually, I wasn't going to ask the question, but ask particularly when you call on people in the front rows that you could might repeat what they're saying.
Very good. I'll do it.
It's, we can hear the back, but we can't hear the
back. Okay. I'll make it a habit. Thank you. Other thoughts? Let's get back to the empty sky. Any other thoughts about the empty sky? And there have been nice things brought up about this internal emptiness that's echoed by the absence of buildings, absence of planes. Is there another kind of absence that we...
There might not be God in his mind.
Yeah, at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There might not. And isn't this maybe a big deal? I mean, yeah, that in a certain sense... I was walking the labyrinth today, and as I walked the labyrinth, my first question was, and I don't know how many of you even know the labyrinth is there, I hope that most of us do, but walk a mile that way, come to a big field, there's a labyrinth, walk it, it's a neat experience. For me, this song is always a little like the labyrinth. You can see the whole thing, it's only 3 minutes long, not that many instruments, not that many words, not that much happens. But you kind of get in there and you start to take these twists and turns. There's a lot going on in this song, and this is what we hire Bruce Springsteen for. He really is a consummate master of the popular song, how to get very few words to mean a lot of things, to be polyvalent and in just very exciting ways. So here we are, no buildings, no planes, and perhaps no God. I mean, there's almost nothing going on in this chorus. Empty sky, I woke up this morning to an empty sky. But all of these things are being said. And in a certain sense, what I guess makes the eye for an eye line so vivid for me is the fact that I think I cheated you all out of this experience. So you walked in here innocently and I put on this song. You might have been able to experience it as I experienced it for the first time, which is to say, not knowing that it was about September 11th. And if you don't have somebody up here saying this, well, you've heard Bruce Springsteen tell this story 24 times before. His woman's gone. His woman's always gone. She's always out there. And he's left with the train whistle or whatever. And this could easily be a song in that vein. I woke up this morning. I could barely breathe. Just an empty impression in the bed where he used to be. I want a kiss from your lips. And so far, this is the river. I mean, this is the kind of song that we expect from him, the kind of love gone bad song that means, well, what those things mean. But then as he says, I want an eye for an eye. And all these things creep up on us, and we realize it's not that she's gone, it's not that she's left him, it's not that she took the night train or something. She's dead. That this woman is gone. And there's a sense in which the way in which this realization sneaks up on us, and the way in which this verse sort of wants to have one meaning but also has a deeper meaning, and the way that the terms, the empty sky does exactly the same thing, there's what finally feels not like a trivial meaning but an obvious meaning, buildings gone. But then there's something much deeper that may be going on too, God gone. Let's listen to the whole song, see what we can do with it. I believe, we're going to pick up right where we left off. I will back up rather messily to the beginning of the second verse.
Thank you.
moment I want to open the conversation on the question of such biblical imagery as does appear in this song. There's a lot going on here, and he's deploying his little sort of biblical gestures very carefully in the song. We'll come there in a second. The one thing I want to point out, however, has to do with the music of the song, and I could sort of pose this as a question and see what came back. But for my money, the question of what does the music do that works especially well, does the music itself have ways of mirroring that kind of process we've just been describing in the lyrics, of laying out something that has a kind of obvious explanation or something that has a straightforward interpretation, and then suddenly having it dawn on us that something much more profound is at work? And I think the answer is yes, it does, in the very simplest terms. As we talk our way into the chorus of this song, there are very few notes in the melody of this song at all. I mean, the whole thing top to bottom just doesn't contain a whole lot of notes. But in the simple phrase, this very simple thing that walks us into the chorus. Well, of course, through the verses, we've been sort of moving between these two chords over and over again, and this is how the song is gone. But when we get into this chorus, and then we run through that again, and we get this chord, a chord we have never heard before, a step below this chord. There's to me a very satisfying effect to this, a sense that suddenly something profound has happened to this little musical gesture. We understand what this one means. It's plaintive and sad, but that's something else. That's something that makes it feel as though the bottom has dropped out, that sort of makes our stomachs fall with something as we listen to that kind of... simple a matter as knowing when to throw in the third chord of the song, just knowing when to throw in something we've never heard before. Springsteen achieves with music the same kind of thing he does with the lyrics. He makes what seemed obvious, sad but in its way obvious, makes it seem like something much bigger, like something much more profound. Now what about those words? What about that biblical stuff? What does he bring in? What does it mean? What is its effect? We've talked about the eye for an eye, the fact that not only do we get this sort of call for vengeance, but as you say, we sort of have the whole baggage of what Jesus had to say about that call for vengeance. You may feel this way, but you shouldn't. We bring that along too. What else do we bring into this song? What's there and what's it doing there?
There's a tree of life.
There's a tree of life. Mm-hmm. And say more, I'm sorry. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil appears to be there. I mean, in a sort of elliptical way, on the plains of Jordan, I cut my bow from the wood of this tree of evil, of this tree of good. What's that all about? Can we say more? I mean, he's throwing stuff around pretty casually. I don't know what the plains of Jordan are to begin with. Can some biblical, help me out. I mean, there's a sort of Jordan Valley. Most of us have some idea how this goes. We kind of have Israel over here, and then the Sea of Galilee up there, and then running for about 60 miles due south into the Dead Sea is the Jordan River. And we have kind of the Jordan Valley along here, Jordan on this side of it, and about 200 miles this way is Iraq. And who knows, maybe the plains of Jordan can be thought in some metaphorical way to extend that far. Who knows? Who knows where the plains of Jordan come from? But they have this sort of evocation of at least a kind of biblical weight, a biblical gravitas.
And Jordan is the border to the Promised Land.
Yeah, yes. It's on the other side of the Promised Land. Across the Jordan River. So I don't know if you want to go that far, but certainly, as you say, it's just an amazing evocation in a song where suddenly there's a little biblical allusion beforehand, but this just sort of cracks the thing wide open.
So what does the Promised Land have to do with this song? What do you, Doug? What?
What it feels like is that it feels like you're outside of the Promised Land.
Wondering in the wilderness.
That's one place to go with.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you're left with a kind of choice.
Great.
And it's the Al Qaeda came from the same place, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Somewhere back,
yeah,
the enemy came from the same place.
Right, right. That we, I mean, we're being sort of situating this story geographically somehow. You're going to, was there more? Oh, I thought I saw another hand. Yeah. Other? How is this song supposed to make us feel? I mean, if this is somehow country musicians, whom we'll be talking about tomorrow, country musicians tend to make it all easier. Whether we like what they have to say, as many of us will, or don't like to have what they say, as many of us will, at least you kind of understand what you're supposed to do with a country song, about to be an American, or at least I know I'm free. Well, maybe we like the song, maybe we don't, but at least we understand where it's coming from. Where is this song coming from? I mean, is this a... those of us who were in this class on Monday talked a little about Springsteen's Born in the USA, about the contentious way in which President Reagan in particular described it as a song of hope. There is nothing hopeful about that song. I've got a brother at Khe Sanh fighting off the Viet Cong. They're still there. He's all gone. There's nothing hopeful about this song. And Ronald Reagan apparently had not ever heard the song, but he had this idea that a song called Born in the USA must be a song of hope, and he didn't get it. What about this? Is this a song of hope?
No.
Okay. What's it a song of?
To me, listen, I woke up this morning playing with the sky, especially with that rhythm, just the very same, and it doesn't build, and you were saying the eye for the eye, where's the rage? I think it's a song of impotence, that we all were just so numb and so powerless to do anything back. I mean, the empty sky, empty, you know, this is all I can see, it's, I can't do anything about it.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah, along with that, I'm surprised we haven't talked about the second line.
Okay.
I could barely breathe.
Say more.
Like it's just stopping everything right there.
Great, great. And as we've been learning in Bible study in the course of this week, too, this notion of the breath, for those of you who are in on Tuesday dealing with John, and we got all these different looks at what pneuma in the Bible, the Greek word pneuma, is really all about. This word that means spirit, that means breath, that means wind. And even in a single story, John can use that word pneuma in several different ways. Nobody knows how the spirit works. Nobody knows how the wind blows, where it comes from, and all this. And the idea of being stopped from breathing... well, speaking of reading too much into this song, I mean, goodness knows if he really is talking about John and pneuma and so on. But breath... it's a very important thing if you're going to start throwing biblical imagery around. There's another hand there. Yeah.
He also, before he started with On the Plains of Jordan, there's that little interlude in there where he brings in the Barry Springsteen harmonica.
Right.
And then it just, the music begins getting a lot more complicated after that. And then there's this little kind of motif thing that, it's like a little, almost a normal style Springsteen electric guitar chord when he says the word evil, and it repeats itself again.
Yeah.
When he says I.
Yeah.
And then all sorts of, I guess I kind of got confused listening for things at that point. But
yeah. And the piano starts sort of grinding in with its very feel good.
It becomes
sort
much
of
more Springsteen.
And it starts to kind of rock along, and insofar as it's ever going to rock at all, yeah. What do you do with all that though? I mean, why do you think the second verse sort of? I mean, what's what does that all add up to for you, or is there a... Someone on the back row is ready to bail you out if you want to.
That's okay. Go for it.
Okay, let's hear it.
Well, one of the ways that I was seeing it was that when he talked about, I cut my bow from the wood, wood, is I was viewing this as these stories of goodness.
Mm-hmm.
That he'd been taught in Sunday school,
mm-hmm,
about, you know, the Promised Land and the Jordan and obviously all the
mm-hmm,
all the imagery that we talked about before, and I see him saying this has been thrown out. It doesn't mean anything to me anymore.
Yeah.
This is just canceled it all.
Okay.
And that's what I get from this repetition again and again and again.
Yeah.
And the change in the music.
Yeah.
That things have changed.
Great.
It is not the same.
Great.
Anymore.
And this tale of impotence that we've talked about feeds very powerfully here.
You know, it's interesting how this develops, because it begins in a very particular literally a day and a place. Mm-hmm. Once we start to go on September 11th. So it's very particularized. That line, I want an eye for an eye, starts to open it up into a biblical context. Yeah. Then you hit, I hear the blood of my blood crying from the ground, and I'm hearing Cain and Abel. And so that particular relationship suddenly is getting larger and larger.
Yeah.
And then by the time you hit on the plains of Jordan, that particular, what he's doing is taking something that is a historical moment in this country and really trying to say, this isn't just about this moment. Mm-hmm. There's something really, this is part of something very large and very, very old.
Yeah.
That we've been struggling with for a long time. And it's the problem of good and evil.
Right. So it's not for you the problem of Christianity and Islam. You're talking about good and evil. You're not talking about the great. Fascinating. Here's a,
Well, I was feeling this. He starts out with, he doesn't know what to do with the in the bed there. She's not there. And then there's kind of a confessional something of, I want to react and respond in revenge. Mm-hmm. And then in this last part is, I cut my bow. I'm intentionally doing what Adam and Eve did in response. That I, even though I know it's wrong, I want revenge.
Yeah. Great. Here I go, out of the garden.
I'm doing it. I am Adam and Eve.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm repeating this story.
Right. Excellent. I want to come back to the question of the music and its building. This is a fascinating point. And did you get everything said about that you wanted to say?
Well, the only other thing I could say is that he just starts repeating.
Yeah.
It's not like he's becoming resigned to the whole thing, but it's like he's out somewhere in the future, and I'm becoming more like the old Springsteen again, and the music's more like the old Springsteen.
It's
not this hard driver. It's very severe sound right at the beginning.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's a very interesting way to look at it. And I have to confess, I just don't like this song very much. Just listening to this song, I do not put this song on for pleasure. But then, the people who are in the business of working with Netflix and other online services to figure out what kind of movies you're going to like, they understand now that sort of polling you, trying to figure out who you are as a consumer, and trying to give you good advice about movies, this may be the most valuable commodity they have. But the people in that business, one of the things they struggle with, and they sort of go in interviews and things talking about the struggle, is what do you do about movies that they ought to see anyway? If you have a movie that all the polling data tells you they're not going to like, that is, you know, if you like this, this, and this, if you like Legally Blonde and Caddyshack, you're probably not going to like, whatever, Schindler's List, but you ought to see Schindler's List. And is there any way to sort of write that into the equipment? That's how I feel about this song. That this song does me good somehow. This song sort of gets the wheels turning, whether it actually gives me pleasure to listen to or not. But there is something about the repetitiousness of it, the way in which he seems to push to the very brink of intolerability, the idea of just sort of, the repetitiousness, the being caught in something that you kind of wish you could get out of, but you understand its motoric nature. I'm not sure what to say about it, but closing thoughts about this song. We should,
Does someone have something to say about the fact that it changes from an empty sky to the empty sky, and then the last stanza goes back and forth?
Yeah.
I didn't
either. And I've been dealing with this song for a long time. It must mean something. It probably means something really profound. But I have no idea. What do the rest of us do with that? And we all see what she means, that at times he'll say, I woke up to an empty sky, at times, sometimes the empty sky. Is there a simple answer here?
Could be retrospective, because the empty sky is very much in the moment. And an empty sky, you're a little more removed from it.
Okay.
Or continuing.
Right, or another area of being depressed or something can be an empty sky.
Yeah. Who knows?
An empty sky seems more generic to me, like, okay, this happened to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the empty sky seems more personal, like, wow, that it happened to me.
Yeah. That's a very nice thought. And that's a good place to close with this. It's a very deep with this song. We're not done with it, not. It's a song with which one can do a lot. And I do think it follows its kind of labyrinthine course. I mean, that is, you know, tightly circumscribed, but still many paths to walk.
One thing I got, I don't know if it's intentional on the, who wrote the song, is the senses that he has in there, breathing and lips, which is touching, and then crying, and then hearing the blood. So it's just interesting how he has some of those senses in there that we don't know.
Yeah. Especially when it comes to the blood. Is that really what we expect to do with blood, is to hear it crying from the ground? And you're right. I mean, we have to think about the sensory process itself somehow. This is very interesting. Well, on that note, let us press on. I'm going to hand out another thing. I have my capable assistant has fled the scene. Maybe somebody will return at some point. But here we have 24 copies of another song. And this is a song that... I think chances are not many of us will be familiar with, from Elvis Costello's 1994 album, Brutal Youth. Elvis Costello is an artist that we almost had a chance to deal with on Tuesday, sort of ran out of time and did not get to deal with. He's an artist that nearly any musicologist you meet, and I've met a lot of them who fit this description, and I know what I'm talking about. Nearly any musicologist you meet with a serious investment in popular music probably has a serious investment in Elvis Costello. There are many of us who feel about him that he is just one of the great sort of singer-songwriters of the era. And in fact, I've not really met anybody who sort of listens to music critically for a living who doesn't have a serious kind of respect for Elvis Costello and the breadth of his work, the depth of his work. He's an astounding songwriter. We find him here in a 1994 album, Brutal Youth. I'm going to make no effort whatever to trace this his career, to try to situate this album within the 17-year career that it led up to it. His career really started around 1977. And he's done all kinds of interesting other things since then. What we have here is a kind of piano ballad. I have taught this song before. The first time I taught this song, I made the mistake of not saying a thing about what I thought it was really about. And we spent about 55 minutes working our way around to the very simple question, what is this song about? I've already told you on the poster outside what I think the song is about. It's about the death penalty. And once we sort of understand that, once we read our way through his kind of opaque series of images, these kinds of epigrams, these epigrammatic utterances in which Costello tends to piece lyrics together, once we kind of allow those to piece themselves together into a tale about the death penalty, many things begin to become clear. Let's just give this song a listen in its entirety and see what we have to say about it. In this case, I don't have much of an agenda. I find this an endlessly thought-provoking piece of music, piece of lyrics. I'm going to play it, and you all will take it away. Let's see what we can do with it.
Thank you.
I think there's too much question in this case what the emotional tenor of the entire thing is supposed to be. This is a song, I would think, of profound lamentation. There's not a whole lot of other way, I don't think, to take it. There's something going on in the world, the existence of the death penalty in civilized places, that Elvis Costello has very strong feelings about. What does he get across? With all of his artistry, and his artistry is simply immense, how does he come to this task of trying to speak to us about this? And you can talk about the words, you can talk about the music, dive in, wherever you like.
That whistle, every time he says hour, has to give you the creeps every time that
happens. Yeah, strange sort of instrument.
It's like, oh God. And after you heard all these words, it's like...
Yeah. It's sort of strange instrument that sneaks in there and sort of lingers on this chord. What are your thoughts?
The parts about the cogs and not, he's saying he's trying to keep people from not trying to distance themselves. That's what's going on. But this has nothing to do with me personally.
Okay. And how does he achieve that?
The chorus makes it more personal on the, to me.
Yeah, great. And let's start with the chorus. And we face the same kind of lyrical mind, at least, that we face with Bruce Springsteen, somebody who likes to get words cutting two ways where possible. What is the touch of the hands about? Stay the hands. Arrest the time till I'm captured by your touch. What does that mean? There aren't many words there. It can't be all that hard. What is that about, Peter?
Well, as in the stay of execution, stop the hands from moving.
What? Okay, what hands?
The hands of the clock.
The hands of this clock.
The midnight hour is the favorite hour. That's the first thing in the song, is the Big Ben tolling, boom, and then we go into the song.
Wow. That's a nice thought. And we remember that first chord. It's very difficult to forget. This is not a very good way to score a piano chord, but here it is as the song begins. I mean, it's a very low, rich chord. Big Ben, he says, this is midnight striking, and this is a song about the stroke of midnight, isn't it? I mean, bejeweled movements measure lost and vanished time. And then the question is there any way to get those jewels to stop moving toward each other? Just get the hands of that little machine to stop going so this life won't fly.
oppress the time, not the victim. That's a double
right. Yeah, great. Now, what about machinery in this whole song? I mean, it strikes me that technology, the way he gets right out of the starting gate, talking about the mechanism, figure hanging on a leather band, Cog consults the watch, he cups in his hand, bejeweled movement measures lost and vanished time. And it goes on from there. What is technology doing in this song? What are these images about? Why is he talking about the hands of the watch? I mean, why does that strike him as a good place to start?
I think he's saying that the technology with the process is dehumanizing to him, in his opinion.
Okay.
Is he also, this line, Cog consults the watch? Is
yeah.
he talking, calling the executioner part of the machine?
Well,
I'm thinking Cog is captain of the guard. If you've watched Dead Man Walking or anything like
say,
that.
Say more. What is this
word? There's a guy that it's his responsibility to ensure that the dead man is walking at the appropriate
mm-hmm.
time so that he can
yeah.
be executed at midnight. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so here I lay it out this way. And again, this is a phonetic transcription. Elvis Costello doesn't help with liner notes in this case. And so I write this word Cog as he pronounces it. But yes, it's possible that I've misled you with this presentation, maybe COG, Captain of the Guard, that we're talking about. Or it can be a cog in the machine, this guy who is just in this created thing. What? Yeah, just part of the wheels of justice. Look at this watch. Reflections. Yeah.
Well, so I get the stay the hands and rest the time, but I don't get the till I am captured by your touch. Like, could someone disobey that?
Peter.
Well, till a noose hits me.
Okay.
Stop. Till
yeah.
I saw that negative. I was looking for something positive, but it's anguish. That chorus is just pure anguish.
Yeah.
It's a scream.
Yeah.
What are we doing here?
Yeah. And the touch, in the most literal sense, you know, we're talking about the touch of the hands of the clock, when they touch, when midnight arrives, the big hand and the little hand come together, the hands touch, and the man is captured in whatever sense this is, captured in the noose by the touch of this little, these two little jewels sort of clicking their way around this machine, deciding when he's going to die. Does nature ever get its day in the sun? I mean, that is, it does seem to me that there's a very forceful way in which Costello comes out of the starting gate just saying, look, isn't this outrageous? This guy's got a watch. He's just a guy. It's just a watch. It's in his hand, this thing that you can hold in the palm of a human hand. And it is clicking away the moments of this stranger's life. And this is the way in which Costello wants us to get sort of outraged from the get-go, to try to view this situation as somehow fundamentally absurd, the relationship between human technology and, you know, the taking of a life. So where is nature in this story? Does nature ever work its way back? We have the technology, we have the ragged noose, we have the... the tricky door that gapes beneath the ragged noose. He wants to fix our gaze on that machinery. What about nature? Well, the third and final verse, as you'll recall, and those of you who have the words in front of you can see it, there is this lovely thing, you know, put out my eyes, so I may never spy waving branches as they're waving goodbye. Their vile perfume brings to my mouth a bitter taste. The murmuring brooks had best speak up. What does that mean, the murmuring brooks had best speak up?
Bitter taste in his mouth.
He does have a bitter taste in his mouth. And somehow he wants us to suppose that nature itself is going to cry out against this. That if the brook could talk, the brook would say, come on. This is no way to run a civilization. The murmuring brook had best speak up. And it's there that we get the real payoff. We've heard this melody twice already, but there that musically we really develop an understanding, I think, for what's going on in that first really dissonant thing that's happened. And then we get to the murmuring brook. Thank you. But as we get to that murmuring brook, the murmuring brook, and we get this terribly dissonant chord, this terribly dissonant fall. And so it goes. I mean, it is the most heart-wrenching moment musically in the song, this chord that sort of comes at us from nowhere. Other thoughts about this? Do you like the song? I mean, I find myself captivated by it, but I have played it for people who say, this is just the most tedious thing. What do you make of this song?
It's unsettling, especially the way he ends it. He just stops saying it's over.
Yeah, yeah. And we have found our way by the end of this song into the wrong key. And does that have any significance? That is, I'm going to get some of these chords wrong. Bear with me. But here we are happily trotting along in the key of D major. It, but you know, we're acting as though this is the key we belong in. It's not. This is the key we belong in. And you know, he just sort of snaked his way around to the wrong place, and finally it's there that he leaves us. Does that mean anything? That the song sort of begins and ends in different keys?
This has no coherence.
Okay.
It's an unsatisfying place.
Good.
It's out of alignment.
Right. Yeah. Right. And this has no way for things to end. Yeah. Okay, there's no answer. This is what we want is resolution. And, you know, in the history of classical music, this sort of thing we're experiencing, where a piece spends, say, the first 80% of its length in a single key, but then changes key at the last minute and ends somewhere else, never happens. It's not that it happens just sometimes. It's not that it happens just in Beethoven or something. You know, as far as tonal music is concerned, that is up to the point we get to the late 19th century. This never happens. This is not an option to end a piece of music in the wrong key. And here we do it. What else? What else grabbed you about this thing? Or
in a chorus, it's like there's this momentum. You don't change it. It is just marching.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
You know, lyrically in the third verse there, I see some parallels to the Bible. When the throngs were waving their palm fronds as Christ rode through Jerusalem on a donkey, they were waving goodbye. They may not have known it, but they were waving goodbye.
Yeah.
You know, and then the bitter taste in my mouth, you know, when he was on the cross, he said, you know, I thirst, and they gave him vinegar.
Yeah.
You know, and then you get to the murmuring brook, best speak out. You know, the whole end of that chorus there, or verse or whatever part that is, you know, when it says that the flags may lower as we approach the favorite hour, our society has this weird love-hate relationship with the death penalty, you know? But part of us, our flesh says, yeah, he deserves to die. Mm-hmm. And the other part of us says, who are we to judge?
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, I think the murmuring brook can be society at large. You know, if we the people don't speak up, the laws of the land aren't going to change.
Yeah. Right. That's a very interesting take. And so is the Palm Sunday stuff. Are you there with him? What do we make of this take? That these waving branches put out my eyes, that I may never spy waving branches as they're waving goodbye. Other
well,
thoughts?
Yeah. And the stones will cry out.
Yeah.
The rocks in protest. I mean, the death penalty, the absurdity of the death penalty is what the crucifixion is all about. So those images really fit.
Yeah, great. There's a pastor talking here. He, very good. I mean, that's a very interesting way to take it. All new to me, by the way. I had never thought about that. About this being a Palm Sunday thing, about this being a rocks and stones thing. That's a very interesting take. Now, how seriously do we take those moments? And again, Elvis Costello does tend to write epigrammatically. He tends to write in ways that don't necessarily feel like they owe it to us to make complete sense. There, it feels as though sometimes his lyrics resolve, cohere very nicely, and sometimes they just don't, and we can't quite figure out what he's talking about. What is he talking about, for example, in this chorus? It's "I'm captured by your touch." Blessings, I don't count small mercies and such. The flags may lower as we approach the sacred, the favorite hour. I've been intentionally a little dicey with the punctuation in there because I'm not actually sure how this sentence is to be punctuated. Blessings, I don't count small mercies and such. He says these things. What does this mean? Where would you all put the commas and the periods and the colons and stuff? What does this mean?
The surface, he's talking about perhaps last meals and such, I think.
Yeah. And it's possible that's all he means. What does blessings mean? He just sort of cries it out. It's the highest note of the song, at that point. Blessings.
Well, there's typically a chaplain or a priest available, to receive the last confession from the condemned.
Okay. Stanley Fish made a career of trying to talk about ways, well, much of a career, talking about ways in which we hazard perceptual closure at the end of a poetic line. In the Lycidas sonnet, he must not float, after Lycidas is dead, he must not float upon his watery bier unwept. And so, Fish wants us to think, well, you get to the end of that one line, he must not float upon his watery bier, and you think, well, somebody's going to do something about it. He's not going to die. He's not going to float upon his watery bier. But you begin the next line, unwept. And then, Lycidas is dead. He's going to float on the watery bier. We're just going to cry about it. And this turns out to be sort of sad sense. Are we dealing with the same thing here? When he cries out, blessings, I don't count. Do we hazard perceptual closure? Do we think there's a period there? I don't count. Small mercies and such. And then we sort of have to launch on, and I don't know. Maybe not. Not the most profound thought in the world, but who knows? There's something about this sort of cry into the highest reach the song will go for. I don't count. Small mercies and such. I'm not sure what he leaves us with.
Is it grander than that? I just don't count, period.
Yeah.
I'm a life lost. I'm still alive, but that favorite hour is coming.
Yeah.
I don't count.
Great. And at the same time, these minutes are ticking by, but I don't count. That is, the bejeweled movements are measuring lost and vanished time. Yeah, I'm not counting them off. I don't want to measure these things. I don't want to be bound in this way. I don't count. Yeah.
I was thinking in terms of when you go to sleep, counting your blessings, you're content. You're trying to put yourself to sleep. This is somebody who's not counting their blessings, who's not happy to go into
that
long
sleep.
Yeah. That is a...
That's good.
That's a very nice place, I think, to wrap this conversation up. Other closing thoughts before we... Okay. Had we... Oh, yeah. Let's
I took it as the boy was once a blessing in his life, but now he doesn't count due to his sin.
The crime.
Who knows?
That's a so nice it's kind of like blessings.
Yep.
That's one sentence, and then I don't count.
That's great. That's a very nice thought. And of course, nothing is more painful in Elvis Costello, more poignant than those moments when he stops being poetic and just kind of lays it on the table. That there's a tragic place to rule youth. And this is, I don't know, there are ways in which we sort of look at this boy and his brutal youth. Well, it's a very poignant song. 60 seconds for wrap-up. Had we had time, we would have got to U2's Sunday Bloody Sunday, a 1983 song of theirs, off their album War, about a particular moment, January 30th, 1972, a very bad thing that went on between the British Army's 1st Parachute Regiment, who shot 28 civil protesters in Derry in Northern Ireland, 14 of whom would later die. You two go on to reflect on this about the Bloody Sunday.
those of you familiar with this song, I invite you to go out and give it a listen. Those of you unfamiliar with it, well, it was a song I was going to happily put before you, a very interesting piece of music. You know, go find it on your own time if you get the opportunity. Closing thoughts about this whole conversation?
Any chance we can discuss this another time?
It's Sunday, Bloody Sunday.
Yeah.
We'll have to see. I mean, tomorrow's going to be country music. I'll decide what I really value.
Just listen to it. On our way up, time to listen to it.
That's a very nice thought. I'll say my goodbyes. I'll put on the song, and you all can hear it on your way out. Thank you all very much for coming this evening.